You are listening to a report from Free City Radio. Interviews and discussions on social and environmental justice movements around the world, featuring grassroots struggles, voices far away from the halls of political and economic power. I'm your host, Stéphane Christophe, in Montreal, Quebec. For more information, visit www.freecityradio.org. We are joined on the line by a member of the Hassan Diab Support Committee, and this is an organization that has been working against the extradition of Hassan Diab, who is living in Ottawa. And we are joined by Donald Pratt. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first of all, if you could just give us a brief picture as to the key demands, the key points on which the Hassan Diab Support Committee is organizing.
Certainly. First thing I want to stress about this is we're dealing with mistaken identity and an innocent man. I've known Hassan personally for decades. And there's absolutely nothing in my experience and that of many of his colleagues to suggest that he is in any way connected to the kind of accusations that have been made. The situation we're dealing with now, I think, is mainly the problems with a very unjust, unfair extradition law. The process that Hassan has been going through since 2008 has involved a situation where the requesting state, i.e. France, has essentially all the advantages. And Hassan is put in a situation where the burden is completely on him to show his innocence. So it's kind of a Kafkaesque reversal of what you would normally expect. In the extradition law, basically, the requesting state can submit sort of a brief document summarizing, you know, whatever cherry-picked evidence they claim to have. They don't really have to back that up with any real documentation at this point. And this information, it has to be considered by a Canadian court as, quote, presumptively reliable. So that means then in order for Hassan to fight extradition, as is his legal right in Canada, he has to mount incredible sort of battery of evidence to knock down whatever the French have put forward. The case itself is shot through with secret unsourced intelligence. It's the whole basis on which they claim this is the guy, right? So that's one huge problem. How can you defend yourself when you can't even get behind and test allegations that are from sources completely unknown? And the other issue that I think is really going to be decisive in this case has been the use by the French of a series of handwriting reports. The person they claim to have been involved in this bombing back in 1980 in Paris scribbled in very simplistic block letters a few words on a hotel registration card, which French have repeatedly asserted and tried to show matches Hassan's writing. The first two shots at it, they basically were shown to be using handwriting that wasn't even Hassan's. The third one, which has now been kind of known as the Bissotti Report, that's the name of the analyst, was shown by three highly regarded defense experts, all working independently. They all said that this report is based on no recognized methodology in the field of handwriting analysis, that essentially it's entirely flawed, its conclusions are utterly unreliable. Nevertheless, in June 2011, the extradition judge felt, because of Ontario's very narrow interpretation of the Canadian extradition law, that he had to allow extradition based on this incredibly weak evidence, I would say non-evidence. So that's a kind of the some of the real big challenges that we are dealing with.
Okay. Now, for people who are not aware, Hassan Diab is being alleged by French authorities to be involved with a bombing that took place in France. Can you briefly explain that for us, and then also detail any additional points that you think are important in regards to the quote-unquote evidence in this case? I've done some reading about it, and it seems that basically the French, aside from the documents you've presented and explained just now, there's actually zero evidence in regards to Hassan's involvement. If you could address those two topics, I'd really appreciate it.
The charges that the French have made, and I actually, not even sure charges is the right word, but I'll explain that. Let's just say the crime in question was a bombing that occurred in Paris in 1980 outside of a synagogue. The French have evidence that someone planted a bomb on a motorcycle that was parked outside of the synagogue, that when it exploded, it killed, I believe, two passersby and injured a number of other individuals and, of course, caused significant property damage. And they've been looking for, they actually say it was done by a group of people, so they've been looking for the group ever since then. And it's an investigation that's had a long history of stops and starts, and it was not until 2008, actually, that they said, oh, we think we found somebody, and, of course, they took that to be Hassan Diab. So that's sort of the issue in terms of what the French are looking for. As far as the French legal system and the challenges in terms of the evidence, as I've described, the case itself is riddled with secret unsourced intelligence, and the only thing that the Canadians have thought was worth considering for extradition was one entirely flawed handwriting analysis, which is being contested now through the appeal process. The other thing, of course, is that Hassan has offered repeatedly to answer questions from the French on Canadian soil, to take a polygraph. There has been no response from the French to these offers. And, you know, it was really a shock. This is getting back to this issue of charged, that after the entire lengthy extradition hearing process and the judge gives his ruling in favor of France, we discover during the ministerial process, this is when the minister has to decide whether or not to surrender Hassan, which he did in April 2012, that the French aren't even wanting Hassan to stand trial. They're simply wanting him for questioning. And according to Canadian extradition law, this isn't even a acceptable grounds to hand over a Canadian citizen to another country. So that's that was a real shock. That is something that continues to be a point of contention in the appeal process. I want to also point out that the French legal system is also an issue here. If Hassan were to indeed be extradited, and if the French were, perhaps after he languished for years in a French jail, they decided, yeah, we really do want to put him on trial, he would be facing the French counterterrorism judiciary, which is operating under a sort of inquisitorial legal process. It's quite different from the adversarial legal process we're familiar with in North America. Furthermore, the magistrates who basically run this counterterrorism judiciary in France have very cozy relationships with the intelligence services, and those services supply whatever, you know, secret information they have to the magistrates in a way that allows the magistrates to, quote, judicialize this information, to turn intelligence into so-called courtroom evidence. Human Rights Watch has documented the use of this kind of intelligence in these French counterterrorism courts, and this information is often obtained from countries with very poor human rights records. So another issue here is, you know, are we looking at potentially putting Dr. Diab on trial based on information that was extracted through torture? So these are some of the real concerns that are, you know, quite shocking and disturbing for us.
Okay. Just now you mentioned Dr. Diab. Hassan has been a professor in Ottawa. I'm wondering if you could share a few details for our listeners about who Hassan Diab is.
Certainly. Dr. Hassan Diab is a former sociology professor. He was teaching at Carleton and the University of Ottawa up until his arrest. He's a graduate, a PhD in sociology from Syracuse University. In fact, that's where we met. He is an academic who takes a great interest in writing and, doing research. And, you know, all those activities have been disrupted now because he's been unable to find employment since his arrest. And so on the one hand, he's completely lost his source of income. And on the other hand, now he's been placed under a great financial burden because he has the almost completely unique situation where if he doesn't want to go into detention, where he would have now been languishing for years, he has to pay every month approximately $2,000 for a GPS device that he must wear at all times. So in addition to his legal fees, he has this additional great financial burden. Hassan is, you know, I would characterize him as a humanist. You know, he's very typical as a sociologist, and I'm a sociologist myself, someone who's interested in all people from all walks of life, abhors things like bigotry and discrimination, including anti-Semitism, and he abhors violence and finds, you know, it just utterly ridiculous that these kinds of charges would be brought against him.
Can you speak at all to the climate of racism against Arab and Muslim people and communities in North America over the last decade after 9/11 and how you feel that has or has not impacted this case?
Well, I do think that this case does illustrate yet again the problems we've seen with the so-called war on terrorism. Again, you have a man from the Middle East, a Muslim, so he's I think being profiled here, especially given how, you know, incredibly weak any kind of identification is in this case. So you have a man who, is falsely accused of terrorism-related offenses. And again, you see, as in other cases we've seen in Canada, the use of secret evidence, profiling of individuals based on their ethnic or religious background. These things are very troubling. And again, you have to look at this case and see, I mean, there's no evidence. What is the basis for going after this guy other than some kind of he's from that part of the world, So I think everyone needs to be reminded of cases like these and the dangers inherent in targeting individuals based on their background.
The final question I wanted to ask you was to just describe the efforts that you're making as a support group for Hassan Diab and some of the recent initiatives that you've been involved in.
Sure. One of the big initiatives we've had is the 100 for Hassan campaign, and this is an effort to get signatories to a statement. We've been particularly, disturbed by the burdening of Hassan and his family with this $2,000 a month for the GPS. So what we've asked is for individuals who want to become members of the 100 for Hassan campaign to contribute $20 or more per month to help defray the cost of the GPS device. And those individuals sign a statement. We've also developed a photo wall with pictures of and statements from those people, which will be posted on our website soon. And we've actually been fortunate enough to recently reach a milestone of about 100 signatories. We do welcome additional contributions because individuals contribute on a sort of subscription basis, and so we're always looking for new folks who may want to replace folks who've been on for 6 months or 12 months and are, you know, not necessarily renewing. So we always welcome new contributions, but we have been quite happy to see the huge outpouring of support around this campaign, and that's been very heartening.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Folks who want to learn more about the case, we encourage you to visit our website, which is justicehassandiab.org.
You've been listening to a report from Free City Radio. Interviews and discussions on social and environmental justice movements around the world, featuring grassroots struggles, voices far away from the halls of political and economic power. I'm your host, Stéphane Christophe, in Montreal, Quebec. For more information, visit www.freecityradio.org.